Disc 3.
Anyway, after talking it over with Miss O'Shaughnessy, I thought maybe I could get something out of him about Miles's and Thursby's killings. So I asked him to come up here. Maybe we put the questions to him a little rough, but he wasn't hurt any. Not enough to have him cry for help. I'd already had to take his gun away from him again. As Spade talked, anxiety came into Cairo's reddened face. His eyes moved jerkily up and down, shifting their focus uneasily between the floor and Spade's bland face. Dundee confronted Cairo and brusquely demanded,
"Well, what have you got to say to that?"
Cairo had nothing to say for nearly a minute while he stared at the lieutenant's chest. When he lifted his eyes, they were shy and wary.
"I don't know what I should say," he murmured.
His embarrassment seemed genuine.
"Try telling the facts,"
Dundee suggested.
The facts?
Cairo's eyes fidgeted, though their gaze did not actually leave the lieutenant's.
"What assurance have I that the facts will be believed?"
"Quit stalling. All you gotta do is to swear to a complaint that they took a poke at you, and the warrant clerk will believe you enough to issue a warrant that'll let us throw him in the can."
Spade spoke in an amused tone. "Go ahead, Cairo. Make him happy. Tell him you'll do it, and then we'll swear to one against you, and he'll have the lot of us." Cairo cleared his throat and looked nervously around the room, not into the eyes of anyone there. Dundee blew through his nose in a puff that was not quite a snort and said,
"Get your hats."
Cairo's eyes, holding worry and a question, met Spade's mocking gaze. Spade winked at him and sat on the arm of the padded rocker.
"Well, boys and girls,"
he said, grinning at the Levantine and at the girl with nothing but delight in his voice and grin,
"we put it over nicely."
Dundee's hard, square face darkened the least of shades. He repeated peremptorily,
"Get your hats."
Spade turned his grin on the lieutenant, squirmed into a more comfortable position on the armchair, and asked lazily,
"Don't you know when you're being kidded?"
Tom Polehouse's face became red and shiny. Dundee's face, still darkening, was immobile except for lips moving stiffly to say,
"No, but we'll let that wait till we get down to the hall."
Spade rose and put his hands in his trousers pockets. He stood erect so he might look that much farther down at the lieutenant. His grin was a taunt, and self-certainty spoke in every line of his posture.
"I dare you to take us in, Dundee," he said. "We'll laugh at you and every newspaper in San Francisco. You don't think any of us is going to swear to any complaints against the others, do you? Wake up, you've been kidded. When the bell rang, I said to Miss O'Shaughnessy and to Cairo, 'It's those damn bulls again. They're getting to be nuisances. Let's play a joke on them. When you hear them going, one of you scream, and then we'll see how far we can string them along before they tumble.'" And
Bridget O'Shaughnessy bent forward in her chair and began to laugh hysterically. Cairo started and smiled. There was no vitality in his smile, but he held it fixed to his face. Tom, glowering, grumbled,
"Cut it out, Sam."
Spade chuckled and said,
"But that's the way it was.
And the cut on his head and mouth?"
Dundee asked scornfully.
"Where'd they come from?"
"Well, ask him," Spade suggested. "Maybe he cut himself shaving."
Cairo spoke quickly before he could be questioned, and the muscles of his face quivered under the strain of holding his smile in place while he spoke.
"I fell. We intended to be struggling for the pistol when you came in, but I fell. I tripped on the end of the rock and fell while we were pretending to struggle."
Dundee said,
"Horse feathers."
Spade said,
"Well, that's all right, Dundee, believe it or not. Point is that that's our story and we'll stick to it. The newspapers will print it whether they believe it or not, and it'll be just as funny one way as the other, or more so. What are you going to do about it, huh?"
"It's no crime to kid a copper, is it?"
"You haven't got anything on anybody here. Everything we told you was part of the joke. What are you going to do about it?"
Dundee put his back to Spade and gripped Cairo by the shoulders.
"Can't get away with that,"
he snarled, shaking the Levantine.
"You belch for help, and you've got to take it."
"No, sir,"
Cairo sputtered.
"It was a joke. He said you were friends of his and would understand."
Spade laughed. Dundee pulled Cairo roughly around, holding him now by one wrist and the nape of his neck.
"I'll take you along for packing a gun anyway," he said. "And I'll take the rest of you along to see who laughs at the joke."
Kyra's alarmed eyes jerked sidewise to focus on Spade's face. Spade said, "Don't be a sap, Dundee. The gun was part of the plan. It's one of mine." He laughed. "Too bad it's only a .32. Or maybe you could find it was the one Thursby and Miles were shot with." Dundee released Cairo, spun on his heel, and his right fist clicked on Spade's chin. Bridget O'Shaughnessy uttered a short cry. Spade's smile flickered out at the instant of the impact, but returned immediately with a dreamy quality added. He steadied himself with a short backward step, and his thick, sloping shoulders writhed under his coat. Before his fist could come up, Tom Pullhouse had pushed himself between the two men, facing Spade, encumbering Spade's arms with the closeness of his barrel-like belly and his own arms.
"No, no, for God's sake!"
Tom begged. After a long moment of motionless, Spade's muscles relaxed.
"Then get him out of here quick," he said.
His smile had gone away again, leaving his face sullen and somewhat pale. Tom, staying close to Spade, keeping his arms on Spade's arms, turned his head to look over his shoulder at Lieutenant Dundee. Tom's small eyes were reproachful. Dundee's fists were clenched in front of his body, and his feet were planted firm and a little apart on the floor, but the truculence in his face was modified by thin rims of white showing between green irises and upper eyelids.
"Get their names and addresses," he ordered.
Tom looked at Cairo, who said quickly,
"Joel Cairo, Hotel Belvedere."
Spade spoke before Tom could question the girl.
"You can always get in touch with Miss O'Shaughnessy through me."
Tom looked at Dundee. Dundee growled,
"Get her address."
Spade said, "Her address is in care of my office." Dundee took a step forward, halting in front of the girl.
"Where do you live?"
he asked. Spade addressed Tom.
"Get him out of here. I've had enough of this."
Tom looked at Spade's eyes, hard and glittering, and mumbled,
"Take it easy, Sam."
He buttoned his coat and turned to Dundee, asking in a voice that aped casualness,
"Well, is that all?"
and taking a step towards the door. Dundee's scowl failed to conceal indecision. Cairo moved suddenly towards the door, saying,
"I am going to, if Mr. Spade will be kind enough to give me my hat and coat."
Spade asked, "What's the hurry?" Dundee said angrily,
"It was all in fun, but just the same you're afraid to be left here with him?"
"Oh, not at all,"
the Levantine replied, fidgeting, looking at neither of them.
"But it's quite late, and I'm going. I'll go out with you if you don't mind."
Dundee put his lips together firmly and said nothing. A light was glinting in his green eyes. Spade went to the closet in the passageway and fetched Cairo's hat and coat. Spade's face was blank. His voice held the same blankness when he stepped back from helping the Levantine into his coat and said to Tom, "Tell him to leave the gun." Dundee took Cairo's pistol from his overcoat pocket and put it on the table. He went out first, with Cairo at his heels. Tom halted in front of Spade, muttering,
"I hope to God you know what you're doing."
Got no response, sighed, and followed the others out. Spade went after them as far as the bend in the passageway, where he stood still until Tom closed the corridor door. Bridget. Spade returned to the living room and sat on an end of the sofa, elbows on knees, cheeks in hands, looking at the floor and not at Bridget O'Shaughnessy, smiling weakly at him from the armchair. His eyes were sultry. The creases between the brows over his nose were deep. His nostrils moved in and out with his breathing. Bridget O'Shaughnessy, when it became apparent that he was not going to look up at her, stopped smiling and regarded him with growing uneasiness. Red rage came suddenly into his face, and he began to talk in a harsh, guttural voice. Holding his maddened face in his hands, glaring at the floor, he cursed Dundee for 5 minutes without break, cursed him obscenely, blasphemously, repetitiously in a harsh, guttural voice. Then he took his face out of his hands, looked at the girl, grinned sheepishly, and said,
"Childish, I know, but by God, I do hate being hit without heading back."
He touched his chin with careful fingers. Not that it was so much of a sock at that. He laughed and lounged back on the sofa, crossing his legs. Cheap enough price to pay for winning. His brows came together in a fleeting scowl. Though I'll remember it. The girl, smiling again, left her chair and sat on the sofa beside him.
Oh, you're absolutely the wildest person I've ever known, she said. Do you always carry on so high-handed?
I let him hit me, didn't I?
Oh, yes, but a police official...
It wasn't that, Spade explained. It was that in losing his head and slugging me, he overplayed his hand. If I'd mixed it with him, then he couldn't have backed down. He'd have had to go through with it, and we'd have all had to tell that goofy story at headquarters. He stared thoughtfully at the girl and asked, What did you do to Cairo?
Nothing.
Her face became flushed.
I tried to frighten him into keeping still until they had gone, and he either got too frightened or stubborn and yelled.
And then you smacked him with a gun?
I had to. He attacked me.
You don't know what you're doing. Spade's smile did not hide his annoyance. It's just what I told you. You're fumbling along by guess and by God.
I'm sorry,
she said, face and voice soft with contrition.
Sam.
Sure you are. He took tobacco and papers from his pockets and began to make a cigarette. Now you've had your talk with Cairo. Now you can talk to me. She put a fingertip to her mouth, staring across the room at nothing with widened eyes, and then, with narrower eyes, glanced quickly at Spade. He was engrossed in the making of a cigarette.
Oh, yes,
she began.
Of course.
She took the finger away from her mouth and smoothed her blue dress over her knees. She frowned at her knees. Spade licked his cigarette, sealed it, and asked, Well? Well, he felt for his lighter.
But I didn't,
she said, pausing between words as if she were selecting them with great care.
Have time to finish talking to him.
She stopped frowning at her knees and looked at Spade with clear, candid eyes.
We were interrupted almost before we had begun.
Spade lighted his cigarette and laughed, his mouth empty of smoke.
Want me to phone him and ask him to come back?
She shook her head, not smiling. Her eyes moved back and forth between her lids as she shook her head, maintaining their focus on Spade's eyes. Her eyes were inquisitive. Spade put an arm across her back, cupping his hand over the smooth, bare, white shoulder farthest from him. She leaned back into the bend of his arm. He said,
Well, I'm listening.
She twisted her head around to smile up at him with playful insolence, asking,
Do you need your arm there for that?
No.
He removed his hand from her shoulder and let his arm drop down behind her.
You're altogether unpredictable,
she murmured. He nodded and said amiably,
I'm still listening.
Oh, look at the time,
she exclaimed, wriggling a finger at the alarm clock perched atop the book, saying 2:50 with his clumsily shaped hands.
Uh-huh. It's been a busy evening.
Oh, I must go.
She rose from the sofa.
This is terrible.
Spade did not rise. He shook his head and said,
Not until you've told me about it.
But look at the time, she protested. And it would take hours to tell you.
You'll have to take them then.
Oh, am I a prisoner?
She asked gaily.
Besides, there's the kid outside. Maybe he hasn't gone home to sleep yet.
Her gaiety vanished.
You think he's still there?
It's likely.
She shivered.
Could you find out?
I could go down and see.
Oh, this... Will you?
Spade studied her anxious face for a moment and then got up from the sofa, saying,
Sure.
He got a hat and an overcoat from the closet.
I'll be gone about 10 minutes.
Oh, do be careful,
she begged as she followed him to the corridor door. He said,
I will,
and went out. Post Street was empty when Spade issued into it. He walked east a block, crossed the street, walked west 2 blocks on the other side, crossed it, and returned to his building without having seen anyone except 2 mechanics working on a car in a garage. When he opened his apartment door, Bridget O'Shaughnessy was standing at the bend in the passageway, holding Cairo's pistol straight down at her side.
"He's still there," Spade said.
She bit the inside of her lip and turned slowly, going back into the living room. Spade followed her in, put his hat and overcoat on a chair, said,
"So we'll have time to talk,"
and went into the kitchen. He had put the coffee pot on the stove when she came to the door and was slicing a slender loaf of French bread. She stood in the doorway and watched him with preoccupied eyes. The fingers of her left hand idly caressed the body and barrel of the pistol her right hand still held.
"Tablecloth's in there," he said,
pointing the bread knife at a cupboard that was one breakfast nook partition. She set the table while he spread liverwurst on or put cold corned beef between the small ovals of bread he had sliced. Then he poured the coffee, added brandy to it from a squat bottle, and they sat at the table. They sat side by side on one of the benches. She put the pistol down on the end of the bench near her.
"You can start now between bites," he said.
She made a face at him, complained, "Oh, you're the most insistent person," and bit a sandwich.
"Mm-hmm. Yeah, and wild and unpredictable. What's this bird, this falcon that everybody's all steamed up about?"
She chewed the beef and bread in her mouth, swallowed it, looked attentively at the small crescent its removal had made in the sandwich's rim, and asked,
"Suppose I wouldn't tell you. Suppose I wouldn't tell you anything at all about it. What would you do?"
"Hmm? You mean about the bird?"
"I mean about the whole thing."
"I wouldn't be too surprised," he told her,
grinning so that the edges of his jaw teeth were visible,
"to know what to do next."
"And that would be?"
She transferred her attention from the sandwich to his face.
"That's what I wanted to know. What would you do next?"
He shook his head. Mockery rippled in a smile on her face.
"Something wild and unpredictable?"
"Maybe. But I don't see what you've got to gain by covering up now. It's coming out bit by bit anyhow. There's a lot of it I don't know, but there's some of it I do, and some more that I can guess at. And give me another day like this, I'll soon be knowing things about it that you don't know."
"I suppose you do now,"
she said, looking at her sandwich again, her face serious.
"But, oh, I'm so tired of it. And I do so hate having to talk about it. Wouldn't it be just as well to wait and let you learn about it as you say you will?"
Spade laughed.
"I don't know. You'll have to figure that out for yourself. My way of learning is to heave a wild and unpredictable monkey wrench into the machinery. It's all right with me if you're sure none of the flying pieces will hurt you."
She moved her bare shoulders uneasily, but said nothing. For several moments they ate in silence. He phlegmatically, she thoughtfully. Then she said in a hushed voice,
"I'm afraid of you, and that's the truth."
He said,
"That's not the truth."
"It is,"
she insisted in the same low voice.
"I know two men I'm afraid of, and I've seen both of them tonight."
"I can understand your being afraid of Cairo," Spade said. "He's out of your reach."
"And you aren't?"
"Not that way,"
he said, and grinned. She blushed. She picked up a slice of bread encrusted with gray liverwurst. She put it down on her plate. She wrinkled her white forehead and she said,
"It's a black figure, as you know, smooth and shiny of a bird, a hawk or falcon, about that high."
She held her hands a foot apart.
"Mm-hmm. What makes it important?"
She sipped coffee and brandy before she shook her head.
"I don't know," she said. "They'd never tell me. They promised me £500 if I helped them get it. And Floyd said afterwards, after we'd left Joe, that he'd give me $750.
"So it must be worth more than $7,500.
"Oh, much more than that,"
she said.
"They didn't pretend that they were sharing equally with me. They were simply hiring me to help them."
"To help them how?"
She lifted her cup to her lips again. Spade, not moving the domineering stare of his yellow-gray eyes from her face, began to make a cigarette. Behind them, the percolator bubbled on the stove.
"To help them get it from the man who had it,"
she said slowly when she had lowered her cup.
"A Russian named Kemendov."
"How?"
"Oh, but that's not important," she objected. "And wouldn't help you."
She smiled impudently.
"And it's certainly none of your business."
This was in Constantinople? She hesitated, nodded, and said,
"Amara."
He waved his cigarette at her, saying, "Go ahead. What happened then?"
"But that's all. I've told you. They promised me £500 to help them, and I did, and then we found that Joe Cairo meant to desert us, taking the Falcon with him and leaving us nothing. So we did exactly that to him, first. But then I wasn't any better off than I had been before, because Floyd hadn't any intention at all of paying me the £750 he had promised me. I had learned that by the time we got here. He said we would go to New York, where he would sell it and give me my share. And I could see he wasn't telling me the truth."
Indignation had darkened her eyes to violet.
"And that's why I came to you to get you to help me learn where the Falcon was."
"And suppose you'd got it, what then?"
"Then I'd have been in a position to talk terms with Mr. Floyd Thursby."
Spade squinted at her and suggested, "But you wouldn't have known where to take it to get more money than he'd give you. The larger sum that you knew he expected to sell it for?"
"I did not know," she said.
Spade scowled at the ashes he had dumped on his plate.
"What makes it worth all that money?" he demanded. "You must have some idea, at least be able to guess."
"I haven't the slightest idea."
He directed the scowl at her.
"What's it made of?"
"Porcelain or blackstone? I don't know. I've never touched it. I've only seen it once for a few minutes. Floyd showed it to me when we first got hold of it."
Spade mashed the end of his cigarette in his plate and made one draught of the coffee and brandy in his cup. His scowl had gone away. He wiped his lips with his napkin, dropped it crumpled on the table, and spoke casually.
"You are a liar."
She got up and stood at the end of the table, looking down at him with dark, abashed eyes and a pinkening face.
"I am a liar," she said.
"I
have always been a liar."
"Don't brag about it. It's childish." His voice was good-humored. He came out from between table and bench.
"Was there any truth at all in that yarn?"
She hung her head. Dampness glistened on her dark lashes.
"Some,"
she whispered. "How much?"
Not very much."
Spade put a hand under her chin and lifted her head. He laughed into her wet eyes and said,
"We've got all night before us. I'll put some more brandy and some more coffee and we'll try again, hmm?"
Her eyelids drooped.
"Oh, I'm so tired," she said tremulously. "So tired of it all. Of myself, of lying and thinking up lies. And of not knowing what is a lie and what is the truth.
She put her hands up to Spade's cheeks, put her open mouth hard against his mouth, her body flat against his body. Spade's arms went around her, holding her to him, muscles bulging his blue sleeves, a hand cradling her head, its fingers half lost among red hair, a hand moving groping fingers over her slim back. His eyes burned yellowly. The Belvedere Divan. Beginning day had reduced night to a thin smokiness when Spade sat up. At his side, Bridget O'Shaughnessy's soft breathing had the regularity of utter sleep. Spade was quiet, leaving bed and bedroom and shutting the bedroom door. He dressed in the bathroom. Then he examined the sleeping girl's clothes, took a flat brass key from the pocket of her coat, and went out. He went to the coronet, letting himself into the building and into her apartment with the key. To the eye, there was nothing furtive about his going in. He entered boldly and directly. To the ear,
His going in was almost unnoticeable. He made as little sound as might be. In the girl's apartment, he switched on all the lights. He searched the place from wall to wall. His eyes and thick fingers moved without apparent haste and without ever lingering or fumbling or going back, from one inch of their fields to the next, probing, scrutinizing, testing with expert certainty. Every drawer, cupboard, cubbyhole, box, bag, trunk, locked or unlocked, was opened and its contents subjected to examination by eyes and fingers. Every piece of clothing was tested by hands that felt for telltale bulges and ears that listened for the crinkle of paper between pressing fingers. He stripped the bedclothes. He looked under rugs and at the underside of each piece of furniture. He pulled down blinds to see that nothing had been rolled up in them for concealment. He leaned through windows to see that nothing hung down below them on the outside. He poked with a fork into powder and cream jars on the dressing table. He held atomizers and bottles up against the light. He examined dishes and pans and food containers. He emptied the garbage can on spread sheets of newspaper. He opened the top of the flush box in the bathroom, drained the box, and peered down into it. He examined and tested the metal screens over the drains of bathtub, washbowl, sink, and laundry tub. He did not find the black bird. He found nothing that seemed to have any connection with the black bird. The only piece of writing he found was a week-old receipt for the month's apartment rent Bridget O'Shaughnessy had paid. The only thing he found that interested him enough to delay his search while he looked at it was a double handful of rather fine jewelry in a polychrome box in a locked dressing table drawer. When he had finished, he made and drank a cup of coffee. Then he unlocked the kitchen window, scarred the edge of its lock a little with his pocket knife, opened the window over a fire escape, got his hat and overcoat from the settee in the living room, and left the apartment as he had come. On his way home, he stopped at a store that was being opened by a puffy-eyed, shivering, plump grocer and bought oranges, eggs, rolls, butter, and cream. Spade went quietly into his apartment. Before he had shut the corridor door behind him, Bridget O'Shaughnessy cried, "Who's that?"
"Young Spade, bearing breakfast."
"Oh, you frightened me."
The bedroom door he had shut was open. The girl sat on the side of the bed, trembling, with her right hand out of sight under a pillow. Spade put his packages on the kitchen table and went into the bedroom. He sat on the bed beside the girl, kissed her smooth shoulder, and said, "I wanted to see if that kid was still on the job and to get stuff for breakfast."
"Is he?"
"No."
She sighed and leaned against him.
"I awakened and you weren't here. And then I heard someone coming in. I was terrified."
Spade combed her red hair back from her face with his fingers and said,
"I'm sorry, Angel. I thought you'd sleep through it. Did you have that gun under your pillow all night,
No, you know I didn't. I jumped up and got it when I was frightened."
He cooked breakfast and slipped the flat brass key into her coat pocket again while she bathed and dressed. She came out of the bathroom whistling "On Cuba."
"Shall I make the bed?"
she asked.
"That'd be swell. The eggs need a couple of minutes more."
Their breakfast was on the table when she returned to the kitchen. They sat where they had sat the night before and ate heartily.
"Now, about the bird," Spade suggested presently as they ate.
She put her fork down and looked at him. She drew her eyebrows together and made her mouth small and tight.
"You can't ask me to talk about that this morning of all mornings," she protested. "I don't want to, and I won't."
"It's a stubborn damn hussy," he said sadly, and put a piece of roll into his mouth.
The youth who had shadowed Spade was not in sight when Spade and Bridget O'Shaughnessy crossed the sidewalk to the waiting taxicab. The taxicab was not followed. Neither the youth nor another loiterer was visible in the vicinity of the coronet when the taxicab arrived there. Bridget O'Shaughnessy would not let Spade go in with her.
"It's bad enough to be coming home in an evening dress at this hour without bringing company. I hope I don't meet anybody."
"Dinner tonight?"
Yes.
They kissed. She went into the coronet. He told the chauffeur, "Hotel Belvedere." When he reached the Belvedere, he saw the youth who had shadowed him sitting in the lobby on a divan from which the elevators could be seen. Apparently, the youth was reading a newspaper.
At the desk, Spade learned that Cairo was not in. He frowned and pinched his lower lip. Points of yellow light began to dance in his eyes. Thanks, he said softly to the clerk and turned away. Sauntering, he crossed the lobby to the divan from which the elevators could be seen and sat down beside, not more than a foot from, the young man who was apparently reading a newspaper. The young man did not look up from his newspaper. Seen at this scant distance, he seemed certainly less than 20 years old. His features were small, in keeping with his stature, and regular. His skin was very fair. The whiteness of his cheeks was as little blurred by any considerable growth of beard as by the glow of blood. His clothing was neither new nor of more than ordinary quality, but it, and his manner of wearing it, were marked by a hard, masculine neatness. Spade asked casually, "Where is he?" while shaking tobacco down into a brown paper curve to catch it. The boy lowered his paper and looked around, moving with a purposeful sort of slowness, as of a more natural swiftness restrained. He looked with small hazel eyes under somewhat long, curling lashes at Spade's chest. He said, in a voice as colorless and composed and cold as his young face, "What?" "Where is he?" Spade was busy with his cigarette. "Who?" "The fairy." The hazel eyes' gaze went up to Spade's chest to the knot of his maroon tie and rested there. "What do you think you're doing, Jack?" the boy demanded. "Kidding me?" "I'll tell you when I am." Spade licked his cigarette and smiled amiably at the boy. "New York, aren't you?" The boy stared at Spade's tie and did not speak. Spade nodded as if the boy had said yes and asked, "Bombs rush?" The boy stared at Spade's tie a moment longer, then raised his newspaper and returned his attention to it.
"Shove off,"
he said from the side of his mouth. Spade lighted a cigarette, leaned back comfortably on the divan, and spoke with good-natured carelessness. "You'll have to talk to me before you're through, sonny. Some of you will, and you can tell G I said so." The boy put his paper down quickly and faced Spade, staring at his necktie with bleak hazel eyes. The boy's small hands were spread flat over his belly.
"Keep asking for it and you're gonna get it," he said. "Plenty."
His voice was low and flat and menacing.
"I told you to shove off. Shove off."
Spade waited until a bespectacled pudgy man and a thin-legged blonde girl had passed out of hearing. Then he chuckled and said,
"That would go over big back on 7th Avenue. But you're not in Romeville now. You're in my burg."
He inhaled cigarette smoke and blew it out in a long, pale cloud.
"Well, where is he?"
The boy spoke two words. The first, a short, guttural verb. The second, you.
"People lose teeth talking like that."
Spade's voice was still amiable, though his face had become wooden.
"If you want to hang around, you'll be polite."
The boy repeated his two words. Spade dropped his cigarette into a tall stone jar beside the divan and with a lifted hand caught the attention of a man who had been standing at the end of the cigar stand for several minutes. The man nodded and came towards them. He was a middle-aged man of medium height, round and sallow of face, compactly built, tidily dressed in dark clothes.
"Hello, Sam,"
he said as he came up.
"Hello, Luke."
They shook hands and Luke said,
"Say, that's too bad about Miles."
"Uh-huh, bad break." Spade jerked his head to indicate the boy on the divan beside him. "What do you let these cheap gunmen hang out in your lobby for with their tools bulging their clothes, huh?"
"Yes?"
Luke examined the boy with crafty brown eyes set in a suddenly hard face.
What do you want here?
He asked. The boy stood up. Spade stood up. The boy looked at the two men, at their neckties, from one to the other. Luke's necktie was black. The boy looked like a schoolboy standing in front of them. Luke said,
Well, if you don't want anything, beat it, and don't come back.
The boy said,
I won't forget you guys,
and went out. They watched him go out. Spade took off his hat and wiped his damp forehead with a handkerchief. The hotel detective asked,
Well, what is it?
Damned if I know, Spade replied. Yeah, I just happened to spot him. Know anything about Joel Cairo, 635?
Oh, that one. Phew.
The hotel detective leered. How long has he been here?
4 days. This is the fifth.
What about him?
Search me, Sam. I got nothing against him but his looks.
Find out if he came in last night?
I'll try to.
The hotel detective promised and went away. Spade sat on the divan until he returned.
Nope,
Luke reported.
He didn't sleep in his room. What is it?
Nothing.
I come clean. You know, I'll keep my clam shut, but if there's anything wrong, we ought to know about it so we can collect our bill.
Oh, nothing like that, Spade assured him. As a matter of fact, I'm doing a little work for him. I'd tell you if he was wrong.
You'd better. Want me to kind of keep an eye on him?
Thanks, Luke. It wouldn't hurt. You can't know too much about the men you're working for these days. It was 21 minutes past 11 by the clock over the elevator doors when Joel Cairo came in from the street. His forehead was bandaged. His clothes had the limp unfreshness of too many hours' consecutive wear. His face was pasty, with sagging mouth and eyelids. Spade met him in front of the desk.
Morning,
Spade said easily. Cairo drew his tired body up straight and the drooping lines of his face tightened.
Good morning,
he responded without enthusiasm. There was a pause. Spade said,
Let's go someplace where we can talk.
Cairo raised his chin.
Please excuse me,
he said.
Our conversations in private have not been such that I am anxious to continue them. Pardon my speaking bluntly, but it is the truth.
Well, you mean last night?
Spade made an impatient gesture with head and hands.
What in hell could I do? I thought you'd see that. If you pick a fight with her or let her pick one with you, I've got to throw in with her. I don't know where that damn bird is. You don't. She does. How in hell are we going to get it if I don't play along with her?
Cairo hesitated, said dubiously.
You have always, I must say, a smooth explanation ready.
Spade scowled.
What do you want me to do? Learn to stutter? Well, we can talk over here.
He led the way to the divan. When they were seated, he asked,
Dundee take you down to the hall?
Yes.
How long did they work on you?
Until a very little while ago, and very much against my will.
Pain and indignation were mixed in Cairo's face and voice.
I shall certainly take the matter up with the Consulate General of Greece and with an attorney.
Go ahead and see what it gets you. What did you let the police shake out of you?
There was prim satisfaction in Cairo's smile.
Not a single thing. I adhere to the course you indicated earlier in your rooms.
His smile went away.
Though I certainly wished you had devised a more reasonable story, I felt decidedly ridiculous repeating it.
Spade grinned mockingly.
Sure, he said. But his goofiness is what makes it good. You sure you didn't give them anything?
You may rely upon it, Mr. Spade. I did not.
Spade drummed with his fingers on the leather seat between them.
You'll be hearing from Dundee again. Stay dummied up on him and you'll be all right. Don't worry about the story's goofiness. A sensible one would have had us all in the cooler.
He rose to his feet.
You'll want sleep if you've been standing up under a police storm all night. See you later.
Effie Perrin was saying,
No, not yet,
into the telephone when Spade entered his outer office. She looked around at him and her lips shaped a silent word, Iva. He shook his head.
Yes, I'll have him call you as soon as he comes in,
she said aloud, and replaced the receiver on its prong.
Phew, that's the third time she's called up this morning,
she told Spade. He made an impatient growling noise. The girl moved her brown eyes to indicate the inner office.
Your Miss O'Shaughnessy's in there. She's been waiting since a few minutes after 9.
Spade nodded as if he had expected that and asked, What else?
Sergeant Polehouse called up. He didn't leave any message.
Get him for me.
And G called up.
Spade's eyes brightened. He asked, Who?
G. That's what he said.
Her air of personal indifference to the subject was flawless.
When I told him you weren't in, he said, When he comes in, will you please tell him that G, who got his message, phoned and will phone again.
Spade worked his lips together as if tasting something he liked.
Thanks, darling, he said.
See if you can get Tom Polehouse.
He opened the inner door and went into his private office, pulling the door to behind him. Bridget O'Shaughnessy, dressed as on her first visit to the office, rose from a chair beside his desk and came quickly towards him.
Somebody has been in my apartment, she exclaimed. It's all upside down, every which way.
He seemed moderately surprised.
Anything taken?
I don't think so. I don't know. I was afraid to stay. I changed as fast as I could and I came down here. Oh, you must have let that boy follow you there.
Spade shook his head.
No, Angel.
He took an early copy of an afternoon paper from his pocket, opened it, and showed her a quarter column headed, Scream Routes Burglar. A young woman named Carolyn Beale, who lived alone in a Sutter Street apartment, had been awakened at 4 that morning by the sound of somebody moving in her bedroom. She had screamed. The mover had run away. 2 other women who lived alone in the same building had discovered, later in the morning, signs of the burglars having visited their apartments. Nothing had been taken from any of the 3.
That's where I shook him, Spade explained.
I went into that building and ducked out of the back door. That's why all 3 were women who lived alone. He tried the apartments that had women's names in the vestibule register, hunting for you under an alias.
But he was watching your place when we were there, she objected.
Spade shrugged.
There's no reason to think he's working alone. Or maybe he went to Sutter Street after he'd begun to think you were going to stay all night in my place. There are a lot of maybes, but I didn't lead him to the coronet.
She was not satisfied.
But he found it. Or somebody did.
Sure. He frowned at her feet. I wonder if it could have been Cairo. Yeah, he wasn't at his hotel all night. Didn't get in till a few minutes ago. He told me he'd been standing up under a police grilling all night. I wonder.
He turned, opened the door, and asked Effie Perrin,
Got Tom yet?
He's not in. I'll try again in a few minutes.
Thanks.
Spade shut the door and faced Bridget O'Shaughnessy. She looked at him with cloudy eyes.
You went to see Joe this morning?
She asked.
Yes.
She hesitated.
Why?
Why?
He smiled down at her.
Because, my own true love, I've got to keep in some sort of touch with all the loose ends of this dizzy affair if I'm ever going to make heads or tails of it,
He put an arm around her shoulders and led her over to his swivel chair. He kissed the tip of her nose lightly and set her down in the chair. He sat on the desk in front of her. He said,
Now, we've got to find a new home for you, haven't we?
She nodded with emphasis.
I won't go back there.
He patted the desk beside his thighs and made a thoughtful face.
I think I've got it, he said presently.
Wait a minute. He went into the outer office, shutting the door. Effie Perrin reached for the telephone, saying, I'll try again afterwards.
Does your woman's intuition still tell you that she's a Madonna or something?
She looked sharply up at him.
I still believe that no matter what kind of trouble she's gotten into, she's all right, if that's what you mean.
That's what I mean, he said. Are you strong enough for her to give her a lift?
How?
Could you put her out for a few days?
You mean at home?
Yeah. Her joint's been broken into. That's the 2nd burglary she's had this week. It'd be better for her if she wasn't alone. It would help a lot if you could take her in.
Effie Perrin leaned forward, asking earnestly,
Is she really in danger, Sam?
I think she is.
She scratched her lip with a fingernail.
That would scare Ma into a green hemorrhage. I'll have to tell her she's a surprise witness or something that you're keeping undercover till the last minute.
You're a darling, Spade said. Better take her out there now. I'll get her key from her and bring whatever she needs over from her apartment. Let's see, you oughtn't to be seen leaving here together. You go home now, take a taxi, but make sure you aren't followed.
You probably won't be, but make sure. I'll send her out in another in a little while, making sure she isn't followed.
The Fat Man. The telephone bell was ringing when Spade returned to his office after sending Bridget O'Shaughnessy off to Effie Perrin's house. He went to the telephone.
Hello?
Yeah, this is Spade. Yes, I got it. I've been waiting to hear from you.
Who?
Mr. Gutman. Oh, yeah, sure. Now? The sooner the better. 12C. Right. Say 15 minutes?
Right.
Spade sat on the corner of his desk beside the telephone and rolled a cigarette. His mouth was a hard, complacent V. His eyes, watching his fingers make the cigarette, smoldered over lower lids drawn up straight. The door opened, and Iva Archer came in. Spade said,
"Hello, honey,"
in a voice as lightly amiable as his face had suddenly become.
"Oh, Sam, forgive me! Forgive me!"
she cried in a choked voice. She stood just inside the door, wadding a black-bordered handkerchief in her small, gloved hands, peering into his face with frightened red and swollen eyes. He did not get up from his seat on the desk corner. He said,
"Sure, that's all right. Forget it."
"But Sam," she wailed, "I sent those policemen there. I was mad, crazy with jealousy, and I phoned them that if they'd go there, they'd learn something about Miles' murder."
"What made you think that?"
"Oh, I didn't, but I was mad, Sam, and I wanted to hurt you."
"It made things damned awkward."
He put his arm around her and drew her nearer.
"But it's all right now, only don't get any more crazy notions like that."
"Oh, I won't,"
she promised.
"Ever. But you weren't nice to me last night. You were cold and distant and wanted to get rid of me when I'd come down there and waited so long to warn you, and you..."
"Warn me about what?"
"About Phil. He's found out about your being in love with me. And Miles has told them about my wanting a divorce. Though, of course, he never knew what for. And now Phil thinks you killed his brother because he wouldn't give me the divorce so we could get married. He told me he believed that, and yesterday he went and told the police."
"That's nice," Spade said softly. "And you came to warn me, and because I was busy, you got up on your ear and helped this damn Phil Archer stir things up."
"I'm sorry,"
she whimpered.
"I know you won't forgive me. I'm sorry, sorry, sorry."
"You ought to be," he agreed. "On your own account as well as mine. Has Dundee been to see you since Phil did his talking, or anybody from the Bureau?"
"No."
Alarm opened her eyes and mouth.
"They will," he said. "And it'd be just as well to not let them find you here. Did you tell them who you were when you phoned?"
"Oh, no. I simply told them that if they'd go to your apartment right away, they'd learn something about the murder and hung up."
"Where'd you phone from?"
"The drugstore up above your place." "Oh, Sam, dearest, I..."
He patted her shoulder and said pleasantly,
"It was a dumb trick, all right, but it's done now. You'd better run along home and think up things to tell the police. You'll be hearing from them. And maybe it'd be best to say no right across the board."
He frowned at something distant.
"Or maybe you'd better see Sid Wise first."
He removed his arm from around her, took a card out of his pocket, scribbled three lines on his back, and gave it to her.
"You can tell Sid everything."
He frowned.
"Or almost everything. Where were you the night Miles was shot?"
"Home,"
she replied without hesitating. He shook his head, grinning at her.
"I was,"
she insisted.
"No," he said. "But if that's your story, it's all right with me. Go see Sid. It's up on the next corner, the pinkish building, room 827.
Her blue eyes tried to probe his yellow-gray ones.
"What makes you think I wasn't home?"
she asked slowly.
"Nothing, except that I know you weren't."
"But I was! I was!"
Her lips twisted and anger darkened her eyes.
"Effie Perrin told you that,"
she said indignantly.
"I saw her looking at my clothes and snooping around. You know she doesn't like me, Sam. Why do you believe things she tells you when you know she'd do anything to make trouble for me?"
"Oh, Jesus, you women,"
Spade said mildly. He looked at the watch on his wrist.
"You'll have to trot along, Precious. I'm late for an appointment now. You do what you want, but if I were you, I'd tell Sid the truth or nothing. I mean, leave out the parts you don't want to tell him, but don't make anything up to take its place."
"I'm not lying to you, Sam,"
she protested.
"Like hell you're not," he said. and stood up. She strained on tiptoe to hold her face nearer his.
You don't believe me?
She whispered. I don't believe you.
And you won't forgive me for what I did?
Sure I do. He bent his head and kissed her mouth. That's all right. Now run along. She put her arms around him.
Won't you go with me to see Mr. Wise?
I can't, and I'd only be in the way. He patted her arms, took them from around his body, and kissed her left wrist between glove and sleeve. He put his hands on her shoulders, turned her to face the door, and released her with a little push. Beat it, he ordered. The mahogany door of Suite 12C at the Alexandria Hotel was opened by the boy Spade had talked to in the Belvedere lobby. Spade said, Hello, good-naturedly. The boy did not say anything. He stood aside, holding the door open. Spade went in. A fat man came to meet him. The fat man was flabbily fat, with bulbous pink cheeks and lips and chins and neck, with a great soft egg of a belly that was all his torso, and pendant cones for arms and legs. As he advanced to meet Spade, all his bulbs rose and shook and fell separately with each step, in the manner of clustered soap bubbles not yet released from the pipe through which they had been blown. His eyes, made small by fat puffs around them, were dark and sleek. Dark ringlets thinly covered his broad scalp. He wore a black cutaway coat, black vest, black satin ascot tie holding a pinkish pearl, striped gray worsted trousers, and patent leather shoes. His voice was a throaty purr.
Ah, Mr. Spade,
he said with enthusiasm, and held out a hand like a fat pink star. Spade took the hand and smiled and said, How do you do, Mr. Getman? Holding Spade's hand, the fat man turned beside him, put his other hand to Spade's elbow, and guided him across a green rug to a green plush chair beside a table that held a siphon, some glasses, and a bottle of Johnny Walker whiskey on a tray, a box of cigars, Coronas del Ritz, two newspapers, and a small and plain yellow soapstone box. Spade sat in the green chair. The fat man began to fill two glasses from bottle and siphon. The boy had disappeared. Doors set in three of the room's walls were shut. The fourth wall, behind Spade, was pierced by two windows looking out over Geary Street.
We begin well, sir,
the fat man purred, turning with a proffered glass in his hand.
I distrust a man that says when. If he's got to be careful not to drink too much, it's because he's not to be trusted when he does.
Spade took the glass and, smiling, made the beginning of a bow over it. The fat man raised his glass and held it against a window's light. He nodded approvingly at the bubbles running up in it. He said,
Well, sir, here's to plain speaking and clear understanding.
They drank and lowered their glasses. The fat man looked shrewdly at Spade and asked,
You're a close-mouthed man?
Spade shook his head. I like to talk.
Better and better,
the fat man exclaimed.
I distrust a close-mouthed man. He generally picks the wrong time to talk and says the wrong things, talking something you can do judiciously unless you keep in practice.
He beamed over his glass.
We'll get along, sir. That we will.
He set his glass on the table and held the box of Coronas del Ritz out to Spade.
A cigar, sir.
Spade took a cigar, trimmed the end of it, and lighted it. Meanwhile, the fat man pulled another green plush chair around to face Spade's within convenient distance and placed a smoking stand within reach of both chairs. Then he took his glass from the table, took a cigar from the box, and lowered himself into his chair. His bulb stopped jouncing and settled into flabby rest. He sighed comfortably and said,
Now, sir, we'll talk if you like. And I'll tell you right out that I'm a man who likes talking to a man that likes to talk.
Swell. Will we talk about the blackbird? The fat man laughed, and his bulbs rode up and down on his laughter.
Will we?
He asked, and
we will,
he replied. His pink face was shiny with delight.
Oh, you're the man for me, sir. A man cut along my own lines. No beating about the bush, but right to the point. Will we talk about the blackbird? We will. I like that, sir. I like that way of doing business. Let us talk about the blackbird, by all means. But first, sir, answer me a question, please, though maybe it's an unnecessary one, so we'll understand each other from the beginning. You're here as Miss O'Shaughnessy's representative?
Spade blew smoke above the fat man's head in a long, slanting plume. He frowned thoughtfully at the ash-tipped end of his cigar. He replied deliberately,
I can't say yes or no. There's nothing certain about it either way.
Yet. He looked up at the fat man and stopped frowning.
It depends.
It depends on...
Spade shook his head.
If I knew what it depends on, I could say yes or no.
The fat man took a mouthful from his glass, swallowed it, and suggested,
Maybe it depends on Joel Cairo.
Spade's prompt, maybe, was noncommittal. He drank. The fat man leaned forward until his belly stopped him. His smile was ingratiating, and so was his purring voice.
You could say, then, that the question is which of them you'll represent?
You could put it that way.
It will be one or the other.
I didn't say that.
The fat man's eyes glistened. His voice sang to a throaty whisper, asking,
Who else is there?
Spade pointed his cigar at his own chest. There's me, he said. The fat man sank back in his chair and let his body go flaccid. He blew his breath out in a long, contented gust.
That's wonderful, sir,
he purred.
That's wonderful. I do like a man that tells you right out he's looking out for himself. Don't we all? I don't trust a man that says he's not. And the man that's telling the truth when he says he's not, I distrust most of all, because he's an ass, and an ass that's going contrary to the laws of nature.
Spade exhaled smoke. His face was politely attentive. He said,
Now let's talk about the black bird.
The fat man smiled benevolently.
Let's,
he said. He squinted so that fat puffs crowding together left nothing of his eyes but a dark gleam visible.
Mr. Spade, have you any conception of how much money could be made out of that blackbird?
No.
The fat man leaned forward again and put a bloated pink hand on the arm of Spade's chair.
Well, sir, if I told you, by gad, if I told you half, you'd call me a liar.
Spade smiled.
No, he said, not even if I thought it. But if you won't take the risk, just tell me what it is and I'll figure out the profits.
The fat man laughed.
You couldn't do it, sir. Nobody could do it that hadn't had a world of experience with things of that sort. And...
He paused impressively.
There aren't any other things of that sort.
His bulbs jostled one another as he laughed again. He stopped laughing abruptly. His fleshy lips hung open as laughter had left them. He stared at Spade with an intentness that suggested myopia. He asked,
You mean you don't know what it is?
Amazement took the throatiness out of his voice. Spade made a careless gesture with his cigar.
Ah, hell, he said lightly. I know what it's supposed to look like. I know the value in life you people put on it. I don't know what it is.
She didn't tell you.
Miss O'Shaughnessy?
Yes. A lovely girl, sir.
No.
The fat man's eyes were dark gleams in ambush behind pink puffs of flesh. he said indistinctly.
She must know.
And then...
And Cairo didn't either.
Cairo's cagey. He's willing to buy it, but he won't risk telling me anything I don't know already. The fat man moistened his lips with his tongue.
How much is he willing to buy it for?
He asked. $10,000. The fat man laughed scornfully.
$10,000, mind you, not even pounds. That's the Greek for you. And what did you say to that?
I said if I turned it over to him, I'd expect the $10,000.
Ah, yes. If. Nicely put, sir.
The fat man's forehead squirmed in a flesh-blurred frown.
They must know,
he said, only partly aloud. Then,
do they? Do they know what the bird is, sir? What was your impression?
I can't help you there, Spade confessed. There's not much to go by. Cairo didn't say he did, and he didn't say he didn't. She said she didn't, but I took it for granted that she was lying.
That was not an injudicious thing to do,
the fat man said, but his mind was obviously not on his words. He scratched his head. He frowned until his forehead was marked by raw red creases. He fidgeted in his chair as much as his size and the size of the chair permitted fidgeting. He shut his eyes, opened them suddenly, wide, and said to Spade,
Maybe they don't.
His bulbous pink face slowly lost its worried frown, and then, more quickly, took on an expression of ineffable happiness.
If they don't,
he cried, and again,
If they don't, I'm the only one in the whole wide sweet world who does.
Spade drew his lips back in a tight smile. I'm glad I came to the right place, he said. The fat man smiled too, but somewhat vaguely. Happiness had gone out of his face, though he continued to smile, and caution had come into his eyes. His face was a watchful-eyed, smiling mask held up between his thoughts and Spade. His eyes, avoiding Spade's, shifted to the glass at Spade's elbow. His face brightened.
By God, sir,
he said,
your glass is empty.
He got up and went to the table and clattered glasses and siphon and bottle, mixing two drinks. Spade was immobile in his chair until the fat man, with a flourish and a bow and a jocular,
Ah, sir, this kind of medicine will never hurt you,
had handed him his refilled glass. Then Spade rose and stood close to the fat man, looking down at him, and Spade's eyes were hard and bright. He raised his glass. The fat man chuckled, and they drank. The fat man sat down. He held his glass against his belly with both hands and smiled up at Spade. He said,
Well, sir, it's surprising, but it well may be a fact that neither of them does know exactly what that bird is, and that nobody in all this wide, whole, sweet world knows what it is, saving and accepting only your humble servant, Caspar Gutman, Esquire.
Swell. Spade stood with legs apart, one hand in his trousers pocket, the other holding his glass. When you've told me, there'll only be two of us who know.
Mathematically correct, sir.
The fat man's eyes twinkled.
But...
His smile spread.
I don't know for certain that I'm going to tell you.
Don't be a damned fool, Spade said patiently. You know what it is. I know where it is. That's why we're here.
Well, sir, where is it?
Spade ignored the question. The fat man bunched his lips, raised his eyebrows, and cocked his head a little to the left.
You see,
he said blandly,
I must tell you what I know, but you will not tell me what you know. That is hardly equitable, sir. No. I do not think we can do business along those lines.
Spade's face became pale and hard. He spoke rapidly in a low, furious voice. Think again and think fast. I told that punk of yours that you'd have to talk to me before you got through. I'll tell you now that you'll do your talking today or you are through. What are you wasting my time for, you and your lousy secret, huh?
Christ. I know exactly what that stuff is that they keep in the sub-treasury vaults, but what good does that do me, huh? I can get along without you. God damn you! Maybe you could have gotten along without me if you'd kept clear of me. You can't now. Not in San Francisco. You'll come in or you'll get out. And you'll do it today!
He turned and, with angry heedlessness, tossed his glass at the table. The glass struck the wood, burst apart, and splashed its contents in glittering fragments over table and floor. Spade, deaf and blind to the crash, wheeled to confront the fat man again. The fat man paid no more attention to the glass's fade than Spade did. Lips pursed, eyebrows raised, head cocked a little to the left, he had maintained his pink-faced blandness throughout Spade's angry speech, and he maintained it now. Spade, still furious, said,
"And another thing, I don't want..."
The door to Spade's left opened. The boy, who had admitted Spade, came in. He shut the door, stood in front of it with his hands flat against his flanks, and looked at Spade. The boy's eyes were wide open and dark with wide pupils. Their gaze ran over Spade's body from shoulders to knees and up again to settle on the handkerchief whose maroon border peeped from the breast pocket of Spade's brown coat.
"Another thing," Spade repeated, glaring at the boy. "Keep that gunzel away from me while you're making up your mind. I'll kill him. I don't like him. He makes me nervous. I'll kill him the first time he gets in my way, and I won't give him an even break. I won't give him a chance. I'll kill him."
The boy's lips twitched in a shadowy smile. He neither raised his eyes nor spoke. The fat man said tolerantly,
"Well, sir, I must say you have a most violent temper."
"Temper!"
Spade laughed crazily. He crossed to the chair on which he had dropped his hat, picked up the hat, and set it on his head. He held out a long arm that ended in a thick forefinger pointing at the fat man's belly. His angry voice filled the room.
"Think it over, and think like hell. You've got till 5:30 to do it in. Then you're either in or out, for keeps."
He let his arm drop, scowled at the bland fat man for a moment, scowled at the boy, and went to the door through which he had entered. When he opened the door, he turned and said harshly,
5:30. Then the curtain."
The boy, staring at Spade's chest, repeated the two words he had twice spoken in the Belvedere lobby. His voice was not loud. It was bitter. Spade went out and slammed the door. Merry-go-round. Spade rode down from Gutman's floor in an elevator. His lips were dry and rough in a face otherwise pale and damp. When he took out his handkerchief to wipe his face, he saw his hand trembling. He grinned at it and said, "Whew!" So loudly that the elevator operator turned his head over his shoulder and asked,
"Sir?"
Spade walked down Geary Street to the Palace Hotel, where he ate luncheon. His face had lost its pallor, his lips their dryness, and his hand its trembling by the time he had sat down. He ate hungrily, without haste, and then went to Sid Wise's office. When Spade entered, Wise was biting a fingernail and staring at the window. He took his hand from his mouth, screwed his chair around to face Spade, and said,
"Wow! Push a chair up!"
Spade moved a chair to the side of the big paper-laden desk and sat down. "Mrs. Archer come in?" he asked.
"Yes!"
The faintest lights flickered in Wise's eyes.
"Going to marry the lady, Sammy?"
Spade sighed irritably through his nose.
"Oh, Christ, no, you start that," he grumbled.
A brief, tired smile lifted the corner of the lawyer's mouth.
"If you don't,"
he said,
"you're going to have a job on your hands."
Spade looked up from the cigarette he was making and spoke sourly.
"You mean you are? Well, that's what you're for. What did she tell you?"
"About you?"
"About anything I ought to know."
Wise ran fingers through his hair, sprinkling dandruff down on his shoulders.
"She told me she had tried to get a divorce from Miles so she could..."
"I know all that," Spade interrupted him. "You can skip it. Get to the part I don't know."
I know, I'm a cheat."
"Quit stalling, Sid."
Spade held the flame of his lighter to the end of his cigarette.
"What did she tell you that she wanted kept from me?"
Wise looked reprovingly at Spade.
"Now, Sammy,"
he began.
"That's not..."
Spade looked heavenward at the ceiling and groaned.
Dear God, he's my own lawyer that's got rich off me, and I have to get down on my knees and beg him to tell me things?
He lowered at Wise. What in hell do you think I sent her to you for? Wise made a weary grimace.
Just one more client like you, he complained, and I'd be in a sanatorium or San Quentin.
You'd be with most of your clients. Did she tell you where she was the night he was killed?
Yes.
Where?
Following him.
Spade sat up straight and blinked. He exclaimed incredulously,
Jesus, these women!
Then he laughed, relaxed, and asked, Well, what did she see? Wise shook his head.
Nothing much. When he came home for dinner that evening, he told her he had a date with a girl at the St. Mark, ragging her, telling her that was her chance to get the divorce she wanted. She thought at first he was just trying to get under her skin. He knew...
I know the family history, Spade said. Skip it. Tell me what she did.
I will, if you give me a chance. After he had gone out, she began to think that maybe he might have had that date. You know, Miles, it would have been like him to...
You can skip Miles' character, too.
Oh, yeah, I didn't tell you a damn thing,
the lawyer said.
So she got the car from the garage and drove down to St. Mark, sitting in the car across the street. She saw him come out of the hotel, and she saw that he was shadowing a man and a girl. She says she saw the same girl with you last night, who had come out but just ahead of him. She knew then that he was working and had been kidding her. I suppose she was disappointed and mad. She sounded that way when she told me about it. She followed Miles long enough to make sure he was shadowing the pair, and then she went up to your apartment. You weren't home.
What time was that? Spade asked.
When she got to your place? Between 9:30 and 10 the first time.
First time?
Yeah. She drove around for 30 minutes or so and then tried again. That would make it, say, 10:30. You were still out, so she drove back downtown and went to a movie to kill time until after midnight, when she thought she'd be more likely to find you in.
End of Disc 3.